Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 3:13 p.m. and that is Central Time, and today is June 21st. And we had a pretty significant reversal on the 10-year Treasury yield today, where at one point it was trading well below 1.4 and closed above and almost at the 1.5% level. So that's at least near-term support for yields and obviously resistance for prices. Of course, what this also suggests is that the turn to growth orientation in terms of what investors are favoring was reversed today, and value took the driver's seat. So we're in an environment where we get this just very swift moving around. It's very easy to be whipsawed in that kind of environment. But we then should just think beyond the short-term machinations of the market and about where are we in the broader spectrum of things. Because when you see big downward dynamics like we saw in a large number of commodities last week, then it's very easy to conclude that this sector must be done for. But the reality is that it's just characteristic of commodity markets. They tend to be volatile, and the best time to buy them is following reactions. Now, that does not mean that one week on the downside is the end of the reaction. But we have seen a number come back into the region of their respective trend means. And then we can also think about the bond markets. And this was a significant reversal. And when we look at the bond price, well, it has been strengthening now for a while, but reversed it in here today. And it's certainly on the price. Over the course of the last 6 weeks, there is this rounding characteristic. So I was quite bullish of bond prices back in towards the end of the first quarter. And my long position was stopped out because of subsequent volatility. I was anticipating that we would get a reversion to the mean, and at least we've had a partial reversion to the mean. Does anybody really, I think, put full credence in the view that the Federal Reserve is at liberty to raise interest rates? This is, I think, one of the biggest considerations, that we've had this huge amount of money moving into repo markets, for example, and that has obviously been this had a significant effect on funding rates. So we also know that playing around with liquidity in the repo market was a contributing factor to the significant sell-off that we had towards the end of 2018. We had initially seen that there was problems in the high-yield market, and it all fed through from the very beginning of 2018, when the Federal Reserve continued to raise interest rates despite the fact that there was a 10% pullback to greet Jay Powell in his new position. It took a 20% pullback at the end of 2018 to put manners on the Federal Reserve, and they stopped raising interest rates, and they put $450 billion into the repo market in the space of 24 hours. So it was a very significant infusion of additional liquidity exactly where it was needed. Now, what we had last week was a similar kind of change in policy. So there's been a lot of money flowing into the repo market because banks have got our excess deposits, and that money has to find a home somewhere. So in some respects, banks have been refusing deposits, and that money's been flowing into the repo market. And the Federal Reserve has been playing around with rates there, so it's going to start encouraging money away from banks. Now, this is problematic, and it's going to have it has the capacity, at least, to create funding issues. And that's part of the reason why bonds were unable to sustain their rally in here today, because the Federal Reserve is not at liberty to do whatever it wants. It has to respond to the wider market environment. There is an awful lot of money floating around looking for a home. And when there is that quantity of cash floating around, then it's going to compress yields in some areas of the market, but it's going to starve other areas of the market for capital. And when we look at the quantity of debt that's outstanding for governments, and they don't really have the ability to raise rates in an aggressive manner without outsized growth. And this is by far the most important consideration, that the Federal Reserve might have said that they want to raise rates twice by the end of 2023, but how are they going to get to do that if growth doesn't surprise on the upside? And for growth to surprise on the upside, we need a lot of activity. And between now and then, there's the question of how the moratoriums on evictions are going to end, how the expiry of excess unemployment benefits are going to affect consumer demand. And then, of course, we have the continued downward pressure on Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was down in excess of 10% today. It's now right back on its lows over the course of the last month, but this is a new closing low. So we had clear evidence of the loss of momentum from back in March. We had the puncturing of the midpoint danger line stop. We had failed upside breaks. Then we got the lower high. Then we got the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. This entire range for the last month looks like a first step below the peak. So there is the clear scope here that Bitcoin has finished going upwards. Now, there's approximately 40 million people in the USA alone own Bitcoin. And just looking at where prices are today, if they bought at any point since the beginning of January, they are either flat or losing money. And of course, in order for prices to go from 30 to 65,000, well, then you have to think that the majority of the purchases occurred closer to the top than towards the bottom of that range. So there are a large number of people who are either short and making money or long and experiencing existential angst at the present moment. And there is no evidence yet that this corrective phase has in fact ended. I think it's also relevant to highlight that the place where Bitcoin has historically tended to find support during these big corrections, and I do mean by corrections, in fact, what I mean is that is bear markets, is around the 1,000-day moving average. And that at the moment is around 13,340. So the price could fall an additional 20,000 and still then only be in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. So obviously there have been forget for a moment just why the Chinese government decided that they were going to clamp down on Bitcoin mining, and think instead about all those 40 million people who are making spending decisions. So it's likely to have an impact on consumer demand. That pushes out the time when the Federal Reserve will be able to tighten policy. And that's a good reason why bond yields are starting to back up. And if bond yields continue to rise, well, then that is beneficial for gold prices, because gold tends to do well in a negative real interest rate environment. And people tend to think of rising yields as being something that deters gold investment. But the reason that bond yields are rising is because people have legitimate concerns about the ability of governments to fund themselves. And then that's also contributing to inflationary pressures, or at least concerns that inflation will eventually get out of control. So that's where negative real interest rates are starting to be priced in. Gold prices were up almost $20 today. Now, that is a shade of the size of the declines that we've seen over the course of the last week. But again, it's not all that surprising that we get these big downdrafts. And the more important point will be if gold can hold a move back above $1,800. What we need to see in order to clearly confirm that gold is back in a demand-dominated environment is a higher reaction low. And we may be seeing the beginnings of that in here today, but it's still a pretty small dynamic move relative to the size of the decline that we had last week. So it might be a little early to draw that conclusion, but we can anticipate that if we are back in a demand-dominated environment, we will get a higher reaction low. And after that, we're back in a demand-dominated environment, and the next move higher in gold is quite likely to take out the peaks put in towards the end or of, well, sorry, the beginning of August, really, last year. So this continues to look like just a lengthy consolidation in the region of the previous all-time peak back in 2011. And then I think it's also particularly relevant to look at the purchasing power parity of gold and this extremely long-term chart where the peak in 2011 coincided with the currency adjust or the purchasing power parity adjusted peak or really close to those peaks at least from back in 1980. I think it is quite likely that by the time this new bull market in precious metals ends, that gold will have traded way out to new all-time highs on a purchasing power parity basis. And I think that's one of the primary reasons to be enthused about the outlook for gold miners. They also, of course, pulled back extremely violently last week. I think it's very unlikely we're going to see gold miners pulling back below the $30 level. And if gold continues to steady, well, then this will be a higher reaction low and will be clear confirmation that the downtrend from that peak in August has been broken. Oil prices were quite firm in here today, with the election success of a hardliner in Iran that delays the time when Iranian supply will come back into the global market. So Brent crude is coming up and testing that $75 level. However, I think it's worth considering that the peak value for crude oil was back in 2008 and around the $140 level. And despite the very impressive rebound from the lows in late 2008, we had a range below 120 for the most part between 2011 and 14. And now we're in a lengthier period of convalescence. So we've been in this long range for 12 years already, and we still have excess supply to work through. So OPEC has still got approximately 8 million barrels that they could bring into the market at will. Venezuela has been knocked out of the market, and you have their oil minister trying to talk up the domestic ability to develop their own production without any help from the outside, which sounds rather fanciful. And then Iran is pretty much excised from the global market as well. So there is a lot of oil supply out there on the sidelines. The spread between West Texas Intermediate and Brent crude has almost closed. And what that suggests is that that has been encouraging onshore domestic supply in the USA back into the market. So I think it's going to be a reach to see prices above $80 on any kind of sustained basis. It's really only a question of how long it takes for OPEC to bring additional supply back into the market. So we're probably, and then let's just think about secular bull markets and how do they form. In commodities, a secular bull market is defined by the rising cost of marginal production. So we had a step change in marginal cost of production after 2005, and now I think it's pretty fair to say that it is very difficult to bring new supply to the market at any price below $40. And the break-even for a lot of unconventional supply has compressed steadily. Over the course of the last decade, it's down now to about $45. So as if prices fall below that level, well, then it's unlikely that it's going to stay below that area for any length of time, and we've plenty of evidence of that for the last 12 years. But what you also need for a secular bull market is a new source of demand. So what is the potential new source of demand for oil? Because obviously we have this big threat to oil demand from electric vehicles. All of the major automotive companies are now going to be producing more electric vehicles, and that's going to cut into demand for new internal combustion engines. And the vast majority of automotive companies have given up on developing new internal combustion engines, so we're not going to have greater efficiency gains in that sector anytime soon. Therefore, in order to avoid the kind of challenge that for oil that, for example, silver experienced with the demise of photographic film, well, then there's going to have to be a new source of demand. Well, I was down in the shooting range yesterday, and I saw for the first time some polymer cartridges. So that was something that really got me thinking about the role of polymers, and glass-infused polymers in particular, because they are extremely strong, and they're very light, they're easily moldable, and then the bigger question is, why haven't we used them in lots of additional sectors yet? And it's because there's simply hasn't been the demand, and the cost has been prohibitive. Well, the cost is becoming less prohibitive. The continued uptrend in copper is creating demand for alternatives. So the vast majority of cartridges or rounds have been made from copper. Copper prices are up in excess of 100% in the last year. So now polymer cartridges are becoming something that is cost competitive. When we think about the significant run-up in lumber prices, then it ate into the demand from the construction sector because it was just becoming too expensive to build homes. So prices were getting beyond the reach of consumers, so they stopped building. Now we've had a significant correction in lumber prices, but prices were limit up again in here today. This is, of course, a contract that moves its limit a lot. But there's the clear scope here that $800 is going to be an area of more than short-term significance, and that potentially prices have reached a new plateau. And it makes sense because the Pacific Northwest of the USA has been devastated by mountain pine beetles. And then there's the additional challenge of wildfires, which are a significant threat as drought conditions prevail. So the vast majority of logging now occurs in the southeast of the USA. And we can also look at the last time that we had a step change in the cost of production. So there's going to have to be a lot more money that is going to be paid to lumberjacks. There's going to be more money introduced into the sector to build logging and additional pieces of infrastructure to get the logs out of these new areas. And then, of course, there's the fuel consideration to get up into these areas. When we look at what happened back in the early 1990s, prices had been ranging below 200 for what must have felt like forever, and then doubled, and subsequently ranged in a very volatile manner between 200 and 400 for the next 30 odd years and broke out. Then we had this big move where it goes from 400 to 600. Then it pulled back into the range, and it looked like that was a failed break on the upside. And then it really went haywire, and prices went from 400 to 1600 in the last year. Now we're back at around the 800 area, So it's quite possible that we could be in for volatile ranging. And that's going to create demand for alternatives. Well, some of the most ready alternatives are polymers. And I've seen a number of articles about the superior quality of polymers, that they are stronger than timber, and that they're perfect to. There are companies now that are producing polymer materials for laying foundations and for basements, and then also as joists for making our building homes. Of course, this is very different from where composite materials were being used in the past for Formula One cars. One thing that I think is interesting too is that Tesla's Cybertruck has been able to achieve cost parity more or less with a Ford F-150 because they were able to use stainless steel, which they can't mold, they can't paint, so they're saving money on both of those by producing this angular design. But stainless steel is also heavy. And if we continue to see the costs of polymers continue to contract, well, then that's likely to be beneficial for the entire automotive sector, because more bodies for cars will be made from polymers, so they'll be stronger and also cheaper to make, and the variety of designs will also improve. And then there's the potential that they'll be used in a whole range of other sectors. And of course, that is why Saudi Arabia or Saudi Aramco bought SABIC and merged the two companies, one being the big oil producer, the other being the big domestic chemicals company. So it's quite likely that oil might be excised from the transportation fuel sector and reintroduced as the transportation materials sector. Because, of course, all of the various different kinds of plastics, well, they all have their origin with fossil fuels. But it's a completely alternative, and perhaps a much more energy efficient and fossil fuel efficient, or carbon emission efficient, way of engaging with this market, if one can take away the burning of fuels and look more at breaking them down through refineries, that might contribute to less emissions overall. Well, BASF, as a major chemicals company, is now firming from the region of the trend mean. When we look at, for example, and I am really struggling to remember how to spell Lyndall Basson, but or Basel, the and I was right, Lyon. There we go. This is indicative of what happened in the materials sector last week. We had the very clear downward dynamics threatening the sequence of higher reaction lows. But it was right in the region of the peaks from 2014 and 2018. We've had a spectacular rally over the last while, and this is also representative of what the wider materials sector did. What I find rather interesting is that the Vanguard Materials ETF is rather heavily weighted by chemicals companies. There aren't that many big miners in the US market, and this does look like a commodity play rather than a chemicals play, but it is primarily about chemicals. And in much the same way that the significant the shale boom created a very significant bull market in the chemicals sector, it's quite likely that the excess supply in the oil market will also contribute to a big boom in the chemicals sector. And natural gas is still in this extraordinarily long range, and even when it rallies from the lower side to the upper side, which is a 200% advance, well, it's still in a secular bear market. So that has been, and I think it's a good example, that whole move in natural gas, where it had the big bull market and then this crushing bear market, laid the foundation for the hydrogen bull market. And now the secular bear in crude oil is creating demand for the alternatives that all rely on copper, but it's also creating the demand for alternatives because of the high price of copper. And this is very similar to what we saw with demand for solar and for wind during the big bull market in oil, that it created demand for alternatives. So I think we're in a rather interesting environment overall, that there are a lot of significant issues, but the first is that there's a lot of money sloshing around, and I don't think that there's a realistic possibility that that supply of new money is immediately going to be damaged. And at the same time, there is the clear bull market in the kinds of commodities that fuel the renewable energy sector, and we're already starting to see movements into the supply response to that big move, which encourages alternatives. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.